Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio. Hello, and welcome to Insert Here, a sex podcast where lust and learning meet. I'm your host, Kate Warren. Each week, I invite a new guest on the show to share their experiences outside the heteronormative or vanilla worlds of sexual expression. Guests bring a wide variety of gender, orientation, and sometimes racial experiences to life through their stories. They approach sexuality in really fascinating ways and talk about how it's informed by who they are and what they've experienced. I invite regular people to share their best tools, tips, and tricks for communicating, thinking about, and of course, having great sex, so you can do the same. Our guest today is Mike Way. Mike is a personal chef and artist who works out of the greater Washington area. He identifies as bisexual, but pretty much only has sex with women, which we'll get into. He co-produced the DC Fetish Ball fashion show, and he's worked in and around the fetish world for the past 15 years. Today, we'll be talking about being a bisexual man, toxic masculinity in 2018, and being a switch man in the fetish community, and more. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, Kate.
Thanks so much for coming on today.
Absolutely.
So to start out, I would love to have you sort of walk us through what your kind of identity labels of choice are.
I think that's such a good question. And I think it's a question that the answer is sort of always changing. In that I think every experience that we have sort of reshapes the way that we look at other people and how we connect to them. For a long time, I identified as a straight man, and I think that was because I grew up in an environment that really only supported one definition of what was quote unquote normal. And I'd say as I learned more, as I pushed my boundaries and became more aware of what the other possibilities were, and when I started questioning things as far as like what I believed was right and what I believed was wrong, it changed over time. And eventually I started to experiment a little bit. Mm-hmm. I guess I was first introduced to the fetish scene. I was going out to dance clubs and such, and a friend who later told me that she was in fact a pro-dom invited me out to an event called Bound, and it was in a lot of ways it was a very sort of informal fetish event. Mm-hmm. In that it was sort of open to the public. You didn't have to like register anywhere. Like they didn't have a list that you had to be on in order to get into it, which is kind of out of the ordinary.
Okay.
Just
really quick for folks who aren't super familiar with that community. Why is that sort of out of the ordinary?
Well, I think that there are laws out there that can potentially get people who run events like that in trouble if you are, for example, having sex in the club. I'm not actually familiar with what the laws are, but mm-hmm. depending on how much people expose themselves, for example, a lot of clubs will have a rule that, like, if you aren't wearing a shirt and you're a woman, that you have to at least have tape over your nipples. You can't have your nipples showing.
Interesting.
And sometimes clubs will make it so that people can walk around naked. I think by having it be a private club that you have to be a member of in order to go into. And so way that you facilitate that is basically you sign up on a website separately, you get a card and so on, and then you can go to the events of that club and play.
Cool. Got it. So your friend who is a pro dominatrix invited you to this club.
And there it was, I didn't know what to expect, but, they had a bunch of different furniture around that, they didn't have, toys specifically for everyone to play. I think, for the most part, people who were involved would bring their own things. And so if you wanted to be able to play in that arena, so to speak, you would have to sort of get to know someone and talk to them and, you know, show that you had interest in something like that. And then they would, you know, would discuss boundaries and what's okay and what's not okay and learn terminology like that.
Cool.
And then you would potentially try it out. And they also, I think that events like that are set up in order to create a space that is safe, a safe where people can feel comfortable taking off their clothes and playing in that way, in some ways a very public way, in a very vulnerable way. And so part of that is they will often have what's known as a DM or a dungeon master,
okay,
a person who is familiar with a set of rules that go along with those spaces of what they consider to be safe, sane, consensual, and what is not okay. And that way they can be the authority that steps in if something doesn't seem like it's going okay, if it seems unhealthy or dangerous.
That's awesome. I wish we were speaking about this earlier. Like, I wish there was a dungeon master at regular clubs too, because it sounds like in fetish spaces, there's a pretty strict, social contract that anyone who's there is required by their peers to follow. And that includes things like communication and consent, like you mentioned, but that's definitely stuff that we would all benefit from having just out in the world, too.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that when I've looked at websites for just regular dance clubs and stuff, they will often have rules, but it seems to be, the extent of it is seems to be like just this is what what proper attire is, or, you know, if they have rules at all. It's not something that is actively talked about. It's sort of like they just kind of expect you to know what is proper and what isn't. And I think that what that sets people up for is an environment that that promotes the idea that it's better to apologize than it is to ask permission. And that's the opposite 100%. Of what I think things ought to be. I think that can set things up to be really disrespectful and uncomfortable for everybody.
Yeah, well, and frankly, like, we are here in the heart of the Me Too movement, and that's why. You know, it's because it's this ask for forgiveness and not permission mentality. But fetish spaces are the opposite, which is great.
Yeah.
So how did you feel when you were there, like, as I assume kind of as a still, like, straight identifying guy who had up until that point probably had pretty heteronormative experiences, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
What was that like?
I would say that one of the things that I noticed immediately is the attitude that people have. I feel like they are, for a lot of reasons, they're just really nice, and they have a tendency. I think you would expect to walk into a place like that and run into people who seem really tough and sort of like very serious about things. But I don't think that that's the truth, and I don't think that's conducive to play. I think everyone understand, or people in that scene understand, that it's about making people comfortable, and it's about facilitating play. And so if you're going to be serious about it, then it's sort of part of a character. But otherwise, I think it's all about helping people feel comfortable and accepting all of the unexpected eccentricities about them that make them so fascinating.
Totally. So how did the fetish community help you kind of explore more?
Well, that's a whole spectrum of different things that I think happened in the midst of it. I think it creates an arena where you can explore. I think the way that I define perversity is kind of maybe similar to poetry in that, or to comedy in that you take things that have a certain the way that people generally understand them, and you tweak it a little bit, you change it to make it different or to make it unexpected. You play with it in a way that I think is not usually what people anticipate. And so I think I started when I did a scene with someone for the first time, what they did is they tied me to what's called a St. Andrew's cross, which is basically like an X made out of wood that's standing up. Mm-hmm. And then they flogged me with a leather cat of nine tails, I guess you could call it, or a flogger. And it actually isn't really, I wouldn't say that it actually hurts very much. Mm-hmm. You can make it hurt if you really try hard and if you really hit a person harder. And there's a whole variety of different things like that. But in the midst of that, I started to pay attention to sensations in a different way. Mm-hmm. I think it blurred the line between what I consider to be pleasurable and what I consider to be painful. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you scratch a mosquito bite, technically it is painful, I think. But you are
it feels really good, too.
Oh, yeah. You're alleviating a tension that's there. Your body is telling you to scratch for a reason. And I think that our bodies and our minds sort of tell us to do things like that in weird ways can seem very self-destructive, but there's a reason behind it when you really are willing to look at it. And so I started exploring sensation play, which what they will often do is they will sort of contrast. They'll hit you with something that that isn't supposed to feel good, and then they might take something that has like bunny fur on it or something, and then touch you with that. So it's sort of like it encourages you to pay closer attention to what you're feeling.
Okay, so then you have like a sting, and then followed by a soft. So the kind of the variety of different sensations really kind of heightens your feeling.
Yeah. And I like a lot of times to compare it sort of to eating, and like when you put salt on things, it sort of intensifies the way that it makes your mouth pay closer attention to the flavors that you're experiencing.
Well, and I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to in the experience of like after you have an orgasm, you a lot of times have kind of full body sensitivity in a way that you don't the rest of the time, you know? So suddenly like a fingertip on your kneecap is like the most erotic thing you've ever felt. Whereas 20 minutes before, you know, that same fingertip on your kneecap would just be like a nothing.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I think that sometimes, or at least something that I've noticed in me, I can't, you know, speak for all guys, but especially when I first started experimenting with my sexuality, when I first started touching myself and stuff, when I had my first orgasm, immediately afterwards, I felt incredibly ashamed. And I think that when I was able to really look at that, it's because your orgasm fulfills a lot of like hunger that you have, and I think that sort of hunger is clouding your vision, your experience. And when you remove that, all of a sudden you become aware of all these things again and like the way you feel. And I think that can be very vulnerable, especially for, well, not just for guys, but for people who are unfamiliar with being so in touch with their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in our society doesn't create a whole lot of space for men to experiment with their sexuality or to like publicly communicate or process their feelings.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It's hard. So you went to the fetish event and you started experimenting. And so talk to me about your transition from considering yourself to be a man who's straight to someone who might be bisexual.
Well, I think I'm not sure exactly when I figured it out. I mean, I think I had crushes on girls before I even went through puberty. Mm-hmm. But I always thought that women were beautiful. I always thought that they were interesting. And going through puberty, everything about me wanted to explore what women were, like to understand better what makes them so different from me. And in a lot of ways, I think in that exploration, in trying to spend a lot of time with women, I think I remember hearing or experiencing a lot of negative attitudes towards men. Mm-hmm. And so I started to sort of like look at guys in that way. I started to sort of like assume that guys were like less able to understand things or just slow.
Okay. So you're sort of perpetuating those ideas in your own head.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least that's how I started to interpret things. But, down the line, when I was in Boy Scouts, I think there was just this ongoing rhetoric of making fun. This was just the place that I was in. I wouldn't say that this is true for all Boy Scouts by any means. But in my area, there was this ongoing rhetoric where you made fun of gay people and where you sort of identified that as sort of like the wrong way to do things, that there was something just weird about that and that you wanted to avoid that at all costs. Mm-hmm. Which is can be very confusing when you're in a place surrounded by men, when you don't have women present. How and in what ways do you go about expressing your sexuality? For the most part, I think you just hide it.
Yeah. Well, and it speaks to that sense of shame that you referenced earlier, too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Perpetuating that.
Farther down the line, I think that there was a moment that was a really great catalyst for me. In that the way that I looked at my sexuality was I tried to imagine being involved with men and it didn't seem appealing to me. And so in comparison to the way that I was imagining being involved with women, which was appealing, and I think that what I couldn't quite get around was this very strong obstacle in my mind that said that that was not okay, that there was wrong. Mm. And I was involved with someone who, in the midst of our relationship, we played with some BDSM, and one night she decided she wanted to do what we call a scene, where she tied me up and she wanted to play. And as part of that, she had something she had gotten from a sex shop. It was sort of a full-sized lollipop penis called a lollycock, and
of course it is. That's awesome.
Yeah, of course. Well,
what flavor was our lollycock?
It was cherry.
Yeah.
Well, and I was actually blindfolded also. I wasn't expecting it, but she just sort of put it in my mouth without my permission.
Okay.
And at first, that was uncomfortable for me because I imagined it. I sort of imagined myself in my mind. I looked at the position I was in, and it was sort of humiliating, and I had a hard time feeling comfortable with that. And the weird thing about the relationship that I was in is, and I don't think that I can actually classify it as a healthy relationship. It was a young relationship, but I think that because I could trust that she didn't really care how I felt about what she was doing, it opened up the possibility for me to look at what I was doing with less responsibility.
Mm. Like you weren't afraid she was going to judge you.
Yeah, yeah. And so at first in that experience, what I thought, okay, well, it's in my mouth and I guess, well, I'll go along with this because I know it turns her on, and I like that. I want to turn her on. Mm-hmm. And then as we continued to play, it got a little more okay. And I started to pay more attention to the fact that I liked the flavor of it. And frankly, I liked the shape of it. It was kind of, there was something comforting in a way about having something in my mouth, making it so that I couldn't speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then as things progressed, eventually I got to a point where it was kind of like, from I'm okay with this to I like this to I love this.
Awesome.
And I never would have believed before that I would want to have a cock in my mouth.
Mm-hmm. So interesting.
Even saying that feels weird.
No, but that's totally fair, because you had been raised in a space that told you that that was wrong and that there was shame associated with it. But it, you know, wasn't until you experienced it yourself and saw that, like, oh, actually, like, that's not true from my own lived experience.
Now, I feel like it might be important to at least acknowledge that mm-hmm. I still have problems with that I think it is a very different thing to have something that's shaped like a cock, or that, you know, that is an imitation versus something that is actually a part of another person. I think that really is a whole different thing to come to terms with. But one of the things that I learned from that experience was that if I was able to justify it in my head or to frame it as it's something that is happening that I don't have to be okay with, like, it's kind of like saying, well, she made me do it.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't your choice, but you liked it.
Right. And the truth is that if I had like shaken my head or like made some motion that to be like, no, don't do this, that she would have stopped. Mm-hmm. I believe that. But the fact that I was able to go, well, I don't have to take responsibility for liking it. I can pretend that I don't. Opened up a lot of possibilities in my mind for being able to explore fantasies in that way.
Cool. So how did you start exploring? Like, did you start like sleeping with men, or was this, you know, something that was kind of more restricted?
So at the time, the people that I spent a lot of time with, in fact, a lot of the people that I know and love are, they would identify as swingers, or which just means that they have an open relationship and they pursue new partners regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there was a lot of openness about sexuality, and there were a lot of opportunities for me to sort of like, I want to say to half experiment without necessarily, you know, without the pressure of having like one-on-one interaction with a guy. I had kissed guys before, but it was weird in that sometimes I felt like I was doing it for other people, that I liked feeling like I was getting attention because of it. But I think that it at least should be acknowledged that, the experience of kissing, a guy is very, very different from that of kissing a girl.
How so?
It feels different sensationally. Guys, typically, or the guys that I've kissed, they move differently. They tend to be more aggressive or to sort of like not move at all. They often have rough faces,
mm-hmm.
Which I think sort of always catches me by surprise, because I'm so used to kissing a face that's soft, mm-hmm. that doesn't have prickles on it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're too aggressive. They like, they kind of go all over my face with their mouth, and I wouldn't like that. Whereas I think a lot of the women that I would kiss would sort of, I would say, find more of a rhyme with my lips. Like,
interesting.
Like we were sort of matching each other.
Uh huh. Yeah. I'd say that's true from my experience kissing men. But it's cool to hear it from you, though, when you have kind of both perspectives.
Mm hmm. I think it's definitely something that people get better at.
Yeah, that's totally true. So you started kind of kissing and experimenting. How did that sort of end up manifesting in your involvement with the fetish community?
Well, I got involved with someone who already had a male partner, and they were in a dom-sub relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that the boundaries around that, for me at least, was that the intention was that I was supposed to sort of be a plaything for her. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, they introduced me to, or they invited me into their bed a few times. And I think that I was really glad that I never felt pressured by him. Mm-hmm. And I think that there were times that I sort of wanted to see what would happen. There was once that I remember reaching up and touching him. But often what I've found with guys is that it's like the moment that I actually feel connected with them, it gets uncomfortable. I think it's very difficult for me to find a comfortable connection with guys. Yeah. And the moment that I touch them in real life, it feels dangerous.
Hmm. So
in a way that's hard for me to describe.
So you sort of like press up against your own boundary there of comfort.
Maybe, yeah.
Do you find that boundary has changed over time as you've had more experiences?
I definitely think that as I've become more willing to look at it, like in my imagination and to talk about it and stuff, it has it's become a lot more comfortable, and the shame has faded a lot, or at least I've been able to, I think, to ground. And I think that this is so key to being able to enjoy pretty much anything, is that you have to be able to place some boundaries around it and know what you decide, you know, mm-hmm. is okay and what isn't.
Right. Well, and it's tricky. We had a recent episode of the show. We had a guest who is queer and has sex with both men and women, and trans men and women as well. And she was talking about like consensual non-consent. So using safe words and things like that to press sort of past people's boundaries in a way that still had boundaries, of mm-hmm. course, where like no doesn't mean no. Pineapple actually means no. But she was saying that she enjoyed that kind of play because it did allow her to sort of push through her own discomfort and discover new things that she didn't know that she liked.
Absolutely. In fact, something that I've been struggling with myself is the notion that a lot of the play that I engage in, I think that I have a tendency to sort of frame it in my mind almost like a performance. And I think that to sort of intellectualize it, or to break it apart into technical bits in my mind, it makes it sort of impossible for me to connect up with the emotional side of it, right. Which is where I think so much of the pleasure is, at least for me.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I think a lot of people, and it depends on who you talk to, of course, but I think a lot of people really feel that their pleasure deepens when they are emotionally connected to their partner.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. And in fact, that's something that I feel like I encounter a lot of times when I am at a party of swingers is this weird attitude that seems very disconnected. And I wonder sometimes how it seems like some people go around looking for all the different ways that a hole will feel different to them. And
oh, interesting.
And totally, like, I'm going to say just the technical aspects of like it doesn't matter who you're sleeping with, like their personality is totally separate from the act.
Right.
And
bodies.
That it's like a game.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, when I imagine that, that seems so, frankly, it seems so boring, because so much of what I find invigorating about sex is the messiness, all of the real parts of people, who they are and what they really want. Mm-hmm. Like, I get bored by people trying to do what they think that I want.
Yes.
I just want people to do what they want to do.
Oh, interesting. So as somebody who identifies as switch, like, how do you navigate that with your partners, and how do you kind of have those conversations?
Well, for the most part, I don't engage in I don't engage in dom sub dynamics officially. Mm-hmm. Like, with my partners, I don't go into it usually being like, okay, so this time you're the dom or this time I'm the sub. I think that it's a dynamic that changes sort of constantly, that in the midst of things, that there's always someone who's sort of like topping the other. I actually mm-hmm. really like that word, top.
Yeah, me
because
too.
I think that it more accurately represents the way that you push your energy towards someone.
Right. Especially if you're not somebody who, like, some people really get off on like dominating someone and like that idea mm-hmm. and that word. I'm a switch too. I err on the sub side of switch, but I find that I'm more dom during foreplay and more sub like during actual like penetrative sex. But I wouldn't choose to use the words dom or sub necessarily either, mm-hmm. Because they are so tied up in kind of these potentially negative ideas of power.
Yeah, I think that they have a lot of stigmas attached to them. They're mm-hmm. weird like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I like top as a term. And I find that it's, I want to say it's the plight of the switch, that it's very hard to find people who really want to top you, or it takes a lot of energy to do that.
Mm.
And more often than not, I think that I find that the people that I want to engage in, and I guess this maybe takes it back to sort of common gender roles, that uh-huh. I feel like there's this expectation of me to be the aggressive one,
oh, yeah.
me to put in the effort and to be on top.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of pressure.
It is. Yeah. Guys are under an incredible amount of pressure to do that and do a lot of things. We're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have more on that and dive deep into toxic masculinity. Stay tuned.
Great.
All of the music on Insert Here produced by Morris, producer out of LA, from DC actually. Find him online, soundcloud.com/pmorris. Be right back.
Welcome back. You are listening to Insert Here. I'm your host, Kate Warren, and today I'm joined by Mike Way. And now we're going to jump into talking about toxic masculinity. There's obviously been a lot of conversation around the role toxic masculinity is played in things like the Me Too movement that we've been talking a lot about. And toxic masculinity, to sort of set the stage, is the idea that men have to be a certain way, and a lot in the most general definition, right? And the man box is very small, and guys have to, quote, be a man, and they take out the trash and make more money than women and have to make the first move and have to be more sexually aggressive and don't express their feelings or cry, or kind of this laundry list of things that leads to a lot of the negative gender dynamics that both men and women experience.
In fact, I think, so Wikipedia, as part of their definition of masculinity, says that Western society includes courage, independence, violence, and assertiveness as pretty much what we define what makes a set of attributes, behaviors, and roles associated with boys and men.
Which is crazy, right? Like, to say that, like, oh, like, for you to, like, be true to like, your gender identity, you have to be violent?
Right.
It's nuts. You know, and that's all. I think there's also a lot of pressure for guys as they're growing up to, and they're socialized to be that way, right? Like, if you're bullied, then you should punch him in the nose.
Right, right. Stand up for yourself.
Right, right.
And I think that there's a lot of common ground to be found in that for both men and women. I think these are characteristics that everyone should learn about, like, and mm-hmm. and place in their lives as far as, like, who they are, you know? Right. To what extent are you a violent person?
Right. Well, and I think looking at, like any system, like social system, looking at your actions and saying, like, okay, like, am I being violent right now because I've been socialized to be violent? Am I reacting mm-hmm. this way?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I refusing to talk about my emotions because I've been taught that that's not okay by society?
Right.
Or is that actually who I am?
Oh, and why?
And why?
Like,
right.
Am I doing this because I'm scared?
Mm-hmm. How do you think toxic masculinity, impacts men?
I think that something that maybe doesn't get looked at very often is the ways in which men face being objectified also.
Okay, let's talk about that.
I think that there's this sort of acceptance, well, for both men and women, of being used at times.
Mm-hmm.
And under what circumstances is it okay? Do you accept being used? You know, is it
right.
if you're getting paid, or is it because you know, there's a task that just needs to get done and has nothing to do with your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that term use, like being used, has a lot of, it can be very illuminating when you apply it to whatever behavior it is that you engage in.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example?
Well, I think that people trade work a lot of times for different things, or people will set expectations. I need to try and be a little more specific about this.
It's okay. We're doing it live.
like, let's say, I'm getting nervous now. Let's say that, there's a car on the side of the road that obviously has a flat tire.
Mm-hmm.
If the driver is a man, I think people might...
He's expected to change that tire himself.
Yeah.
And I can call AAA.
Right. But if a guy called AAA, I think he might get some funny looks.
Yeah, totally. Or get shamed by his friends or, you know, any number of things. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Which isn't fair. Changing a tire is a big pain in the butt. We pay for AAA for a reason.
Well, but I'll tell you that that if I see a girl changing a tire, or if I see a girl, like, I don't know, digging a ditch or doing construction work
yeah.
with a drill, I think that's awesome. I find that a big turn on.
Yeah.
She's capable, you know?
Yes. But there's also a level, I think, of fetishization there also, right?
Sure.
So,
sure, I can see that.
Like, am I like a strong dom woman because I can like hang my own medicine cabinet with a drill? In this case, yes, but not necessarily.
Absolutely. Well, you know? I think that is a standard that everyone should strive for, that everyone should be strong, everyone should be capable.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, there are times that you can't do things.
Right. People, but all people should also be able to express their feelings and their vulnerabilities and to ask mm-hmm. for help, which is really hard yeah. for people.
Yeah, it is hard to ask for help and to know how to ask for help.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think how do you think toxic masculinity plays into asking or not asking for help, right? Like my dad would mm-hmm. never ask for directions growing up. Ever. Like pre-internet, we would just be driving through the middle of nowhere because, like, as a man, he could not ask for help.
Huh. And sometimes I feel like I see that in some of the women that I work with, that they to do things on their own. They don't want to get other people's opinions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, it might just be another way of looking at it. I think that asking for help can be a really
diverse
topic. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I'm like personally very bad at it. And every year I set an intention for myself, and last year was vulnerability, and this year is asking for help. And so far I'm like succeeding in some areas of my life and failing miserably in others. And it takes having people around who are willing to offer that help.
I think that there's also a lot of times this expectation of people that they should try and try until they can't anymore. That it's a sign of weakness to tell anyone that you can't do something or that you're, you know, like that you're getting tired of something. But I think that is
100%.
It's such a dangerous standard. How do you tell someone, you know, I can't hold this anymore if you're carrying a couch?
Right. Exactly. And we're not often taught like how to be strong and ask for help. Like asking for help doesn't, or being vulnerable even, you know, speaking more broadly, doesn't make you weak. You know, I think there's incredible strength in vulnerability, and that translates to sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can be vulnerable about sharing your fantasies or what you are interested in or what you want to experiment with or try, like there's incredible strength in that.
Totally. In fact, I think that one of the strongest things that a partner can do for me, as far as building trust, is to tell me when something is not okay. To say, whoa, stop, that hurts. Or, can we go ride bikes instead?
That's totally fair. So as a guy, and this is actually a question that I get a lot when I'm hosting panels and, you know, when I talk to people about the show, like, how do you recommend that people give the men that they're sleeping with constructive feedback when something isn't working without hurting their feelings?
You know, I struggle with that. Is such a challenging thing to figure out. And I think it depends a whole lot on the person. I think how to go about doing that is a great topic in itself.
Can you give us an example of like what someone might say?
Well, like, I don't know, because I think it's so different between people. Like, sometimes people want things to hurt, and they want you to be... sometimes people want you to be mean to them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people really want you to be sensitive. Mm-hmm. But for me, I guess I always roll with sensitivity first, because once you screw something up, it's so hard to repair that.
100%.
I don't know.
So let's say somebody is like giving you a blowjob, and you've maybe had a long day at work and you're just kind of not in the mood. How do you give that feedback?
That, you know, it's funny. I actually find myself struggling with that currently, because I have a hard time. Blowjobs actually tend to make me uncomfortable. I feel like I need more to occupy myself. Otherwise, my brain starts going around in circles, and I worry about how I look, and it's so hard for me to just relax and enjoy what someone is doing for me.
That's like, actually pretty common. A lot of guys, and there is definitely shame around this too. Like, there are a lot of guys who prefer not to receive oral sex, or just like don't really get off on it for whatever reason, right? Like, they don't like teeth near their penis, and that's real, you know. Or to your point, like, there's not enough like intellectually occupying them or stimulating them. Some people don't have quite as much sensitivity to that as they do for like penetrative sex. All different kinds of reasons, but they definitely can't talk about it as openly. So how are you navigating that with your partner?
Well, the first thing I did was I had this sort of conversation with her. I said, you know, like, it's hard for me to admit when I'm not really into something. I'm afraid of disappointing you by not being into it. Mm-hmm. And I think that acknowledges, I don't know, maybe that there's a lot of dishonesty out there for the sake of trying to please your partner, and maybe you're not doing anybody any favors by not being totally frank about it.
Yeah, 100%.
Maybe nobody wants to sleep with a faker.
I mean, definitely nobody wants to sleep with a faker. So you told her this?
Yeah, and she was incredibly receptive to that.
That's awesome.
And the best part of it was seeing that she didn't take it personally, that she was just kind of like, oh, all right, yeah, that's fine.
Cool.
Tell me.
Yeah, let's find some other stuff that really does turn you on.
Uh-huh, exactly. And it doesn't mean that we don't still try that regularly. I think, in a way, it encourages her to do it when she wants to, as opposed to when she thinks that I want her to.
Yeah, I mean, women are definitely socialized to think that, like, guys are trying to get head, like, all the time. Like, literally all the time. And there definitely is pressure. There, you know, socialized mm-hmm. pressure there, even, and not necessarily that comes from any specific particular partner always. So you're right to mm-hmm. recognize that. And it's good that you guys are sort of post that pressure. Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you that being able to recognize, like, what's real from what's not definitely is worth it. It makes it pours color back into the experiences that I have with my partner, like, as I trust her more, as I'm able to connect with her more and to really believe that what she's doing is because she wants to do it. Mm-hmm. It allows me to worry less about getting it right.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, we're just about out of time, and I'm so, so grateful for you coming on the show. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
This has been wonderful. I could talk to you all afternoon. But,
I know, so soothing.
Just thank you for having me.
No, of course. It's my pleasure. So for folks listening at home, you've been listening to Insert Here. We are a sex podcast where lust and learning meet. We look at identity, gender, orientation, and how those things inform sexuality. If you are interested in being on the show or know someone who would be a great guest, you can email us at insertherepodcast@gmail.com. To listen to more, find us online at inserthere.fullserviceradio.org or search for us on iTunes by searching Insert Here. Stay horny.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.